Mims.
Kansas gets the ball in. Ahead to Timberlake on the run.
It's a block.
And he missed the shot.
Should call a foul?
With the game on the line, that is an incredible Mims. Block that just got taken away from Samford.
Up he goes. And a nice play there. Chase Ross. He flew Mims. Right over my head.
And that's hard to do. That's a big head.
And Oakland with a March memory of a lifetime.
The Mix Pick Sports Show.
Steve, check your cell phone real quick while I introduce the show. You can write to us anytime, rad@radradio.com. Phone number is 888-989-9811. We do have an email from Matt that we're going to start with, but first I must introduce the man I just alluded to, Steve Mickelson, from MixPicks.com. 2Ks in Mix, 2Ks in Picks, MixPicks.com. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
All right, so rather than keep the audience in the dark before I get to Matt's email here, that he wrote in. I had been mentioning you were going to miss Thursday and Friday again this week like you did last week because of March Madness. You're actually going to be gone starting tomorrow for the rest of the week, and then you don't get any more days off until 2025. We're good. We're covered. We've got Danny's going to be back. Danny from Tech to You was with us last week. Dawn's husband, Gary, is going to join us. And, in fact, tomorrow, Kyle, one of my producers on the regular Rad Radio show, is going to sit in. He's a huge Sacramento Kings fan and an emotional one, too. I like to poke at him about various things when it comes to the Sacramento Kings. And he's been following NCAA. So we'll have everything covered for all of you throughout the week. But one of the other things going on is, as I understand it, this is tomorrow that you're going to be on a different podcast. This is very common, by the way. Podcasters joining podcasters, teaming up, cross promoting, helping each other out, things like that. How did this even happen? You're going to be on a Philadelphia based podcast?
Yes, it's a beat writer for the Phillies who covers the Phillies on a daily basis. He also runs the Phillies podcast, so he's asked me on to discuss baseball season win totals, how they've come across, you know, for the many years, and kind of an outlook of this upcoming baseball season, you know, obviously with an emphasis on the Phillies, but just kind of getting an overview of the MLB upcoming season.
Is this part of your I'm slightly overstating, but not really, your somewhat at various times over the last couple decades legendary knowledge of baseball? It's the thing you're great at. It's the thing you love at. I know you've been on various networks off and on throughout the years. Is that how you got to know him and why he invited you on?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm legendary, but there for about 12 years, I was the first one to release Major League Baseball season win totals anywhere in the world. So my totals would go up first, you know, and then everyone would kind of see them and they would adjust them to what they think. I've done interviews all over the country. It's pretty cool because like ESPN and the MLB Network would use my season win totals and do shows on it discussing, you know, what they were. So it was cool hearing, you know, like John Smoltz one time with the comment of, man, whoever comes up with these, you know, and however they come up with these win totals, they're right on. Mad Dog Russo did a whole show on my season win totals, broke down every single game. Tom Verducci used to write an article with Sports Illustrated. He would take all of my season win totals, and then he would write an article on his five best plays that he thought out of, you know, that total I hung. So that's kind of my claim to fame and pretty much what I've been known for in the industry is my baseball and my season win totals.
And now here you are stuck doing this show with me. So
this is a lot of fun. I wouldn't say I'm stuck doing this at all.
It's called Crossed Up, a Phillies podcast. I'll remind everybody about it tomorrow, but that'll be great Steve. So we will hear from Steve again on Monday. I'm going to try to squeeze as much as I can into today, including this email I referenced from Matt, because when we were talking about the NCAA yesterday, I kept saying Gonzaga, and then when Steve was doing his recap, he kept saying Gonzaga, and I said – And I wasn't trying to in any way ridicule Steve. I was saying, look, I hate mispronunciations. I hate when people say Nevada. It's Nevada, goddammit. Matt wrote in and said, Rob, to help you out with the pronunciation of Gonzaga, both ways are correct per peers and alumni which have gone there. But you sent me a text, Steve, yesterday, which I think contradicts that because you made a good point. They have a nickname that I think confirms it's Gonzaga.
Yes, to my knowledge, it is Gonzaga. And the reason is they're also known as the Zags. They're not known as the Zogs.
Right.
And my mistake on mispronouncing it, I believe it's Gonzaga. I didn't realize, you know, I had, you know, moved into that Gonzaga portion. So I apologize to all those Gonzaga fans.
So I want to start with this Ohtani thing. We talked about it yesterday. The Shohei Ohtani story last week, it kind of trickled out. As I mentioned yesterday, you were the one who texted me on Thursday, I think it was. It might have been Wednesday, but either way, I knew we weren't going to be on the air together the next day. And I was like, damn it, I want to get on this right away. Because your first text was something like, Ohtani's going down. And I'm like, well, that's a little extreme. And then more and more of this started to seep out about Ohtani, his interpreter, gambling debts, these enormous withdrawals or transfers from Ohtani's bank account to an illegal bookmaker, and it started to grow. We talked about it yesterday in depth. Yesterday, as promised, Ohtani gave a statement through his interpreter, took no questions from the press. The way it went was Ohtani would read a paragraph or two, and then the interpreter would say whatever Ohtani had said, rather than the usual I'm going to recap everything that's going on story, etc. I'm going to kind of throw this on you, Steve, because we texted a lot back and forth. First thing I got, even before I got a text from you, I got a text from Gary, who joins us on the show now and then, who said, I don't buy this Ohtani thing. And I gave the same line to him that I gave to you. I said, well, we are all of the generation that says this doesn't pass the smell test. And you, it sounded to me in our text back and forth yesterday like you really felt like whatever you call it wasn't a press conference because the press wasn't allowed to ask questions. This statement that was made by Ohtani yesterday made you even more suspect of what's really going on. And for those who have no idea other than what I've said, it's hard. Yes, people who are mega rich have people that handle a lot of their finances, pay their bills, have access to their accounts. The idea that Ohtani had no clue and no concept that $4.5 million is being transferred literally from his account to another, that he had no idea that this best friend of his for 10 years was gambling on all of these various sports they claim not baseball. It starts to get harder and harder and harder to believe. The interpreter has been fired by the Dodgers. The one yesterday is one that's been working for the Dodgers for a decade. But how do you encapsulate the last 24 hours on this story from what you've seen and heard?
Well, I understand the statement, and honestly, I think it went exactly how I expected to go.
Yeah.
I think exactly how that crisis management team was going to lay it out. I still have some serious issues with what they said throughout that whole statement. And one of the first things, the red flags that raised for me out of that statement is that the money was stolen out of Ohtani's bank account and transferred to this gambling organization without Shohei Ohtani's knowledge and nobody's knowledge. Nobody knew this. Well, Ohtani has a lot of people. And let's just say that Ohtani doesn't really keep up with his finances. He doesn't look at his bank statements. He doesn't do anything. I find it hard to believe that the interpreter is also his financial advisor / manager, and he's the one who takes care of all of Ohtani's finances. I have to believe he has a financial advisor, as when you have, as he says, Ohtani's people, that he has someone in there who's managing his assets and look at things. According to what I have read, these transfers started in September and took place in September and October of last year. So you're telling me his financial advisor, manager, whatever the title is, never looks at Ohtani's bank statements either. So this all transpired. Nobody saw $4.5 million transferred out of his accounts and raised any red flags. I don't know about you, but when I do my taxes, I have to give every statement, everything, my credit cards, and my tax guy goes over it with a fine-tooth comb in order to check every transfer, everything to find out, one, if it's deductible, two, how he can classify it, you know, for tax purposes. So, like, not even his tax guys see this and see that there was these wire transfers. And break it down. They said they were in $500,000 increments. For $4.5 million, that means there was at least nine transfers of $500,000 that nobody saw anywhere. Not as financial advisors, not Ohtani looking at any bank statements. And how does an interpreter have total control over all of Ohtani's assets? I don't buy it. I don't think it's right, but that's the way they're painting it. So it all goes on the interpreter, and I think it smells.
I think, and I felt like after watching that, whatever we're calling it, yesterday's statement, that it is exactly the playbook that you predicted yesterday. The interpreter is going to go down. He will be taken care of for the rest of his life, probably by Ohtani for his silence. Pending one thing that I mentioned to you, which I'll mention in a moment first, but I just to pull the curtain back a little bit, I've led a pretty fortunate life, and I do have some financial people that help me out, and I still have control of my bank accounts, and you know, I write my own checks and things like, but I have a lot of things on auto pay and such, and I don't check into my bank account weekly, but certainly monthly, and I will, and because this is what I'm trying to dispel. There might be people that hear things like $4.5 million and go, yeah, but the guy already makes, before his $700 million contract, he makes $50-60 million a year in endorsements or whatever. There is a number in all of our heads, no matter how much you make, where your eyes pay attention. For me, When I'm going through everything that's happened over the last, you know, couple weeks, I might miss or not notice. Oh, okay, I spent $38 on an Uber. Oh yeah, we had an Instacart order for $172. I see something that has four digits, just four digits. I notice $500,000. I don't care that you make $50 million a year. You're gonna notice things like that, which brings me back to the other point that I wanted to make. I think right now, you're right. Shohei's the $700 million man. He's the face of baseball. Everybody wants this to go away, except those of us that want the truth. And your storyline is the perfect one. It's all the interpreter's fault. Go away. However, in my experience with stories like this, there's always somebody else that knows something. And if somebody sees this story and decides, I mean, they might decide they want to do it to get rich, or they might decide they want to do it for the right reasons. If somebody else comes forward and they have proof, they have some evidence, they have a smoking gun, they have something that keeps this story going, that is where this story gets really bad, really ugly, really quick for Major League Baseball. And Ohtani, I think we're probably in a 24 to 72 hour window for something like that to happen. But that, if that shoe drops, I think this story, that's how this story has legs.
And I sent you the article because it was up on ESPN yesterday. And if you read it, it shows that article gives the timelines, breaks it down by what went on by the day, et cetera, what was said and the information that had come out. The thing about that story is, if you look, it said 3 days ago. It wasn't yesterday with what he had said when it originally came out. And according to that article, Ohtani, the interpreter, and Ohtani's agent all said that they were aware of this last year. Ohtani decided to pay it off, and he agreed to the transfers in September and October to the bank account. Yet we watched Ohtani say he knew nothing about any of this until they were in South Korea. There was the team meeting. He kind of got the understanding of what was going on in the team meeting, and he didn't get the full scope of it until afterwards when he met one-on-one with the interpreter. But yet 3 days ago, the writer of this article on ESPN talked about how the agent, Ohtani, and the interpreter all validated that they knew last fall, and that's the reason they went with, let's just pay off the debt. So right there is a contradiction, if the article is correct, a contradiction to what Ohtani said yesterday in his statement, which to me has problems, because that article came out 3 days ago, and one of the two is not correct. And I tend to believe the article from 3 days ago, because that's the way I had heard it had come out, even without that article. But the article backs up, you know, my stance.
I only heard one person yesterday on ESPN mention the name that I mentioned yesterday, and this is where it gets beyond ugly for Major League Baseball. The timing issue you just mentioned makes everything so suspect. The other issue is the extent to which Ohtani may have been involved. Like, okay, he knew it was going on at a different time than he's claiming now, etc. That's bad. It's worse if somebody has knowledge or proof that there was betting, even if it's just the interpreter, and if Ohtani's involved, it's over, if it was betting on baseball. And somebody brought up Pete Rose yesterday. I don't remember who it was, but somebody on ESPN said, look, there's no proof of this, but I think they were positing the question rhetorically, are we even in the stratosphere of this being potentially Pete Rose? And you can't say definitively no. Based on the evidence, it's no right now, but we don't have a lot of real evidence. And that's where, again, and what we're 48 hours from opening day. This is a disaster for Major League Baseball right now, which is why they want this to end.
Absolutely. The part that I think Ohtani, he has to go with the theft, but it came from his account. And I think it was in that ESPN article that they talked about when the interpreter started playing with this bookie, he was making $85,000 a year.
Yes.
Yes. By the time that he's making $500,000, he was making $85,000 a year.
And got $1 million into debt.
And got $1 million into debt. Think about, no bookie in their right mind is going to allow a person who makes $85,000 a year to get $1 million in debt, because they know they will never recover it. You will cut that loss off. You know what, at $20,000, I mean, you're not going to $1 million. You're cutting that off $10,000-$20,000, but it didn't. Why didn't that bookie? And you can't tell me, oh, he was naive. And that's the problem, is the bookie has knowledge and where it goes from here. But
and the
transfers were out of Ohtani's account. How do you hide that?
And that's why I wanted to make this totally transparent to people who maybe are like, wait a minute, what exactly are you guys saying? And what you're implying, or worse, as I understand it, is this, like you said, a bookie who's taking bets from somebody who makes $85,000 a year and allows that person to get $1 million in debt, doesn't let that get anywhere near $1 million unless he knows the money's insured. And it's insured in your insinuation by the fact that this interpreter has access on some level to Shohei Ohtani money. Whether it's Ohtani's version of, I'm stealing it from you, or Ohtani's like, do what you want, or Ohtani's involved, right? I mean, that's what we're saying, is all of these things are on the table.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, think of it like a bank. A bank's not going to let you overextend your credit. They're only going to give you a certain amount. I can't go buy the Houston Rockets because I want to buy them off of my salary. And that's kind of like what you're looking at here. The bookie is the bank. He's not going to overextend the credit to a person without knowing there's ways for him to receive that money back.
Now, you, while we were texting yesterday, kind of tied this in, and it took me a moment to figure out what you were doing, to a completely different athlete in a completely different sport. The Toronto Raptors forward Jonte Porter is under investigation by the NBA following multiple instances of betting irregularities over the past several months, according to ESPN. At issue are prop bets involving Porter from games between January and March, and in the game on January 26th that they're really looking at against the Clippers, there was increased betting interest on the under for Porter props, which for the night were set at around 5.5 points, 4.5 rebounds, 1.5 assists. I don't want to get too far into it, but then comes that night. Porter plays 4 minutes and then leaves the game because of what the Raptors said was an aggravation of an eye injury. All of the unders hit on all of the props. There's a lot more to that story, but this is all part of your concern over sports betting and the ugliness of the legitimacy of all of these leagues, transparency, et cetera. Is that how I'm reading this?
Absolutely. And I don't know if you saw it, but Tyrese Halliburton came out in the last week and talked about how he just feels like a player prop now when he plays because of the sports betting and all of the, you know, his props that go get attached to him, you know, with points scored, assists, and all that other stuff. We saw Gobert get fined because he made the dollar sign, you know, gesture to the referees on a call. I do believe at a certain point the federal government's going to step in and start regulating sports wagering nationwide, not just allowing each state to have their own regulations. But it's becoming really interesting because you're seeing players and coaches talk about how they're getting threats from fans over sports bets when they don't cover. You know, chance at games when it's close to, you know, hey, look, we're up by 15, but the spread is 15.5, and the coach goes to take his players out, and they, oh, what are you doing? You're fixing it. So it just kind of shows the ugliness of the sports betting world now that it is becoming public. I still have made my living as an adult in this industry, working for sports books. I'm not saying get rid of sports betting. I like it. I just think we're going to have some controls, the integrity part, you know, and this goes towards the NBA as well. Really needs to step up. And one of my complaints is several years ago when the Cavs were in the finals and LeBron James broke his hand in the first game, and we didn't hear about it. You know, the NBA claims their integrity. We didn't hear about it until after the series was over, and I believe the Cavs got swept. Last year in the Stanley Cup Finals, the Florida Panthers were really hurt. I mean, these guys, like, shouldn't even be on the ice. They played. They got beat by the Vegas Golden Knights. But then we found out afterwards, you know, this guy had a dislocated shoulder or whatever it was. This guy had, like, torn ligaments in his knee. You know, these injuries that they shouldn't have been on the ice. But as an athlete, you're going to play. Look, this is my opportunity. I want to play. But both sides, the players, the leagues, and the sports books really need to work together for this integrity, because with all the camera angles and everything being on TV, everything is under a microscope, and we see it daily in pretty much every game now that you watch. There's questionable calls, and then there's, look, the fix is in.
As I mentioned, I want to get as much in as possible with Steve since it's our last day of the week with him. There's a few emails about the baseball story. I want to talk a little bit about the Major League Baseball season, which, yeah, it began last week, but it didn't really. There's also some basketball news, and there's some major NFL news as well that we've got to cover, and we're going to fix it in somehow in the next 30 minutes, I promise.
Knicks Picks, the Knicks Picks Sports Show. Let's
go! Quite a few emails coming in. We'll start with this one, RAD@radradio.com, from Kyle. Back to the Shohei Ohtani story. He asks, if it comes out that Ohtani is involved, which involved how would be my question, but either way, can the Dodgers get out of the contract without ramifications?
I don't have the answer to that. You would like to believe they could, but
depends on the level.
Disciplinary action is going to come from the commissioner.
Yeah, and it depends on the level of involvement. I mean, if it comes out that Ohtani was betting on baseball, it's over. If it comes out that Ohtani knew his interpreter was betting on baseball and was backing it, I think it's over. Other than that, you know, you get into contract negotiations, things like that, or contract verbiage and such.
And keep in mind, the Players Association's never, under their power, going to allow that contract to be voided, because that sets up the leverage for future contracts, you know, to compete at that level like Ohtani received.
Here's a funny line. TJ wrote in and said, I saw last night that Pete Rose himself on TikTok said, quote, I wish I had me an interpreter, end quote. That it, yeah, right? You can hide behind, and we don't, okay. All right, Willie wrote in. We were talking about how Steve's going to be on a different podcast tomorrow, not because he's abandoning us, but because he's been asked to be on Crossed Up, a Phillies podcast, talk about the upcoming Major League Baseball season and more. And Steve, for years, was posting preseason, you were posting win totals for the entire league. Is that the short version?
Yes, okay. I would release them usually the Thursday after the Super Bowl. Super Bowl would hit. I would take that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday off and just, you know, crunch my numbers, and we would release it on Thursday. It would go out to all the major publications, networks, all across the country, and they would start just lining up interviews, you know, Thursday, starting on that Friday, and it would be go.
So Willie wrote in, I love the way he writes this. First of all, he says, Rob, I don't need your opinion. Steve, A's win total this year, over or under 59.5?
I would lean towards the under. I mean, they're just not good. You know, and normally the rule of thumb was, you know, you'd start at no teams should win more than 100 games. No team's going to lose more than 100 games. And you kind of adjusted it from there. The Houston Astros blew that out of the water a couple of years ago, you know, losing like 115 games or whatever it was. There's no incentive for the A's to put a quality product on the field. If I'm the A's general manager, I'm investing all of my money into player development. I'm trying to make sure that when we move to Las Vegas, we have a quality product that we could put out on the field that first year and be somewhat competitive, and a strong farm system to keep us competitive for the next several years. Just not sure the A's will follow that, you know, guide and actually do that.
So the season, quote unquote, really does start on Thursday. Monday is not too late for us to go back and really dive in with Steve on the various. We've talked a little bit about it, but dive in on the various divisions and what he sees. But you have never been shy, Steve, especially with football, about before the season begins making the big one. Last September, you said the Super Bowl would be the Niners and the Chiefs. You had the Niners winning. You never wavered. You admitted throughout the season a couple times, it's not looking good, but I'm sticking with the Chiefs and the Niners. There was that period where the Chiefs weren't the Chiefs. We were talking about their offense. There was that three-game losing streak for the Niners. You kept saying Niners, Chiefs, Niners, Chiefs. Now, the only thing that didn't happen was the Niners didn't win, but that was you back in September. So today, who's in the World Series and who wins?
Well, man, I haven't even given that much thought.
I'll tell you what. I will circle back Monday, and I'll give you a chance to make it official. But as of right now, what do you got?
If I would look at it, I'm probably leaning towards the Braves because I think they're really solid top to bottom on that roster. The Dodgers, to me, still has some serious questions in their rotation. You would have asked me prior to Gerrit Cole going down, I would have said the Braves, Yankees. Oh. But now I have serious questions on the Yankees staff. I love this Orioles team. I think they have a lot of good talent. Picking up Corbin Burns to me was huge. And the Astros, everyone's given them so much credit and putting them as they're going to win the West. But they have serious concerns out of their starting rotation as well. The Rangers, if they can be hanging there, you know, until DeGrom and Scherzer can get back and those two pitchers can return to form, this Rangers team is going to be really good the second half. But if I had to pick right now, I would lean towards the Braves beating the Orioles in the World Series.
All right, we'll go back Monday. I know you got March Madness all week, and you got time to look at it. We'll get the official numbers. Some games just of interest, just regionally. On Thursday, the Giants will be at the Padres. That's an afternoon game at 1 o'clock. And the A's will host Cleveland at 7 o'clock. The thing I'm most interested about that is opening night in Oakland, what the attendance will actually look like. I want to jump to basketball for a couple reasons. We have been talking about how this season will set the record for the NBA of most come-from-behind victories of 20-point or more deficits. It's already second, I believe, for 15 and 10 point deficits. It's been one of those seasons where your lead is never safe. Last night, the Atlanta Hawks rallied from a 30 point deficit against the NBA best in terms of record leading Boston Celtics, with DeAndre Hunter clinching a three-pointer with 9.2 seconds remaining, and the Hawks won a 120 to 118 stunner over the Celtics, who had won 20 of 22 and brought a nine-game winning streak into State Farm Arena. Great story. Is it just an anomaly, or is it something else?
No, I think it kind of shows that Celtics weakness. If you look at this, I believe the Celtics have lost multiple games this year, not just last night. I would probably put them at like three or four where they've blown 20-point leads to lose. They've really fallen apart. They lost to, I want to say, the Cavaliers a couple of weeks ago in that same situation. I want to say they were up like 20 with about 10, 11 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, and they lost that game. The Celtics hit that fourth quarter, and they go to that slowdown ball, and it really takes them out of rhythm, and it just seems they cannot get it and pick it back up, which come playoff time, the NBA playoffs become much more that half-court offense. And with the Celtics, you know, they rely so much on the three-point ball. I think they're on pace to, like, break the record for highest, you know, three-point shooting percentage in a season. But, man, that's the one big concern I have with the Celtics, is their inability in the fourth quarter to close out these games, even when they have big leads.
If you look at the Western Conference, we've been talking a lot the last few days about the Kings, the Mavericks, the Suns, all within a half a game of each other. The Lakers are two games back. You've got the Clippers two games up on those teams. The reason I bring that up is because the Phoenix Suns, they went out last night against the San Antonio Spurs, and Bradley Beal, the guard for the Suns, didn't mince any words last night, calling it not just a disappointment, but saying we just got our ass kicked. The coach, Frank Vogel, says it was an unacceptable game to lose, especially since star rookie Victor Wembanyama wasn't playing, and somehow the Suns lost 104 to 102. To the Spurs,
which is embarrassing. I mean, it really is. Wembanyama, we've talked about him on the show. He is one of the most exciting young players in the game. But this has been my concern with the Suns that we've talked about in the past. Really, they have three players. I mean, Booker, Beal, and Durant. Outside of that, there's not a whole lot of contribution on that team. We watched it again yesterday. When you're in this playoff hunt, you cannot lose these kind of games. You know the Spurs are playing for nothing. Wembanyama's out. They could lose this game by 20 points, and it's really not going to affect them in any way. But to give them momentum and allow them to stay in the game just shows where the Suns, and I don't give the Suns a whole lot of credit to go deep into the playoffs. I don't think they can. Yes, they got three great players, but they have nothing else that goes with this team.
And this is kind of their version of what the Kings let happen with the Wizards last week. You cannot lose these games, which brings us to tonight. And it was just a week ago or so that, 2 weeks ago, you were high on the Dallas Mavericks. And then you were like, not so much. Well, now the Dallas Mavericks, they're right back there. They're right in that mix with the Kings, the Suns, and then there's the Mavericks. They're all within a half game of each other. Tonight, Steve, the Dallas Mavericks are at the Sacramento Kings. What do you see there?
And right now the Kings are a one-point favorite. The Kings, nice win last night, and their defense stepped up. I mean, Maxey early on in that game was lighting it up for the Sixers. They figured out how to contain him, and once they took him out of the game, that Sixers offense really kind of went away. But one of the things that I like to see when the Kings are playing well is the points in the paint. I think they had 52 points in the paint last night. They had more points than their opponents. I like it when the Kings take it to the hoop, because I think that allows the defenses to collapse, which then gives them better open shots from the outside. And to me, when the Kings are taking it to the hoop and scoring in the paint, Those are the games to me that they usually win and look at their best. It was a good defensive effort. As I said, they took away Maxey. The Mavs, you know, they're playing for that spot right now. The two teams are tied, but because the Kings hold right now the head-to-head matchup, that's the reason the Kings are in the sixth seed and the Mavs are in the seven. But, you know, Irvin is starting to play a lot better with Doncic. I like the big guys they brought in. I was disappointed early on after the trading deadline. They didn't mesh, but they're playing really good basketball. I believe they're 8-2 in their last 10 games. This is a really good game. The Kings really need to win this, and I'm excited to watch this.
And if they do win it, they finally get better at what you've been talking about, that the Kings never cover the spread at home. If they win it, they'll cover that 1-point spread at home finally.
Absolutely. This is that pick 'em game, just like we had a few games back where it was that, look, I really like the Kings to win this game. You know, there were, I believe, a 2-point favorite, or it was pretty close. No, it was actually a pick 'em game, which was just pick the winner, and the Kings went on to win that game.
By the way, what is this weird scheduling anomaly where Dallas plays at Sacramento tonight, and then nothing happens again until Friday when Dallas plays at Sacramento again? That is so screwy.
Maybe they're going to Disneyland.
Right?
I don't know. Normally, when you're going to play the team twice in a row in the same place, they play back-to-backs. But both of these teams are playing the second game of a back-to-back tonight, which means they got to have time off. But, you know, and I haven't looked at the schedule, but, you know, to sit there and say the Mavericks have to sit in Sacramento for three days before they play their next game, that's a big disappointment for the Mavericks. I wouldn't be happy with that schedule at all.
Hey, I live in Sacramento. I don't know what they're going to do for 3 days. Believe me.
Mix Picks, the Mix Picks Sports Show.
Let's go!
All right, I mentioned there was some big news out of the NFL, which is still the biggest thing. Doesn't matter if they're playing or not. And there's a few things I've got to get from Steve before he takes the rest of the week to work on March Madness. What was a rumor has now been confirmed. The old school rule used to be that the NFL, you know, once college goes away, they start playing those Saturday games. And then if Christmas and Christmas Eve fall in that Saturday, Sunday, Monday-ish window, they'll play NFL games and they'll kind of space them out. But it's always been, well, Tuesday, Wednesday, we don't play NFL games. The rumor was last night, you know, we really got some enormous viewership this last season. Should we play on Christmas, which is a Wednesday this year? It is now confirmed that NFL games on Christmas Day will continue in 2024 with two matchups, despite the holiday falling on a Wednesday. We don't know the matchups. We do know that the Christmas Day games have generated massive television ratings. ESPN's Ravens 49ers game, which was the primetime game for Christmas this year, had more than 27 million viewers, making it the second most watched Monday Night Football game since 1996. The three games they played on Christmas averaged 25 million viewers compared to the NBA, which always does Christmas games, which average 4.5 million viewers. Business standpoint makes sense. We don't know the teams. We don't know the games. They're talking about, okay, how do we do this? Does this mean we're going to have to give, it's late in the season, but whoever's playing on Christmas Day, we got to give those four teams a bye the Sunday beforehand, so that you're shaking your head. You don't like this idea.
No, I'm shaking my head because I get what you're saying, and that was my first initial thought, but it's not fair to those teams, and I don't get my bye until, what, week 15 or whatever it is out of an 18-week schedule. No, what you're going to watch is the teams, because once we hit December, they start playing games on Saturday. So what's going to happen is the four teams that play on Christmas Day will be playing on that Saturday, because it'll be the same as a Sunday playing a game on Thursday. They're going to play a Saturday with a game on a Wednesday. So they're going to have those days off, and then they're going to just roll into the following Sunday, you know, with that extra rest for the following week. I don't think any of those teams have a bye going into it or out of it. I believe you will, when you see the schedule, all four of those teams will play on Saturday the week before.
Wow. Okay, so what I was wondering was, because there's no winning. let's pretend that they did give him the bye on week, like you said, week 15, which is really late. They play on Wednesday. Well, the best they can do then is play on the following Monday, which is still too soon.
Well, yes, and it's going to be – they're going to play on, say, the Sunday and then the Saturday and then the Wednesday. So you're looking at three games in, what is that, a 10-day period for those teams from the Sunday, Saturday, and Wednesday. That late in the season where injuries are already piling up on these rosters, and if you're a good team, you want to be healthy going into the playoffs – this could be devastating if it turns out to be quality teams. But why are you playing on a Saturday if you're going to have the Panthers playing, you know, the Chicago Bears? I mean, there's no interest in that Christmas Day game because the goal is to drive the ratings and the advertising dollars. So you're going to put quality teams in there, but those teams are really are in for a tough stretch with three games in 10 days.
And I think we're about 3-ish weeks, give or take, where we already know who all of the teams are playing. We don't know the exact scheduling. So we will get that news in 2 or 3 weeks, and then we'll have a better idea of how they're going to lay that. There's a rumor as well that I think has been squashed that they were even considering a Christmas Eve game on Tuesday night, which convolutes this even more. The big thing yesterday, the thing that everybody was talking about in the NFL, it's that time of the year where they start talking about rules. And NFL owners have approved a rule to ban the hip drop tackle. You and I talked about this earlier in the year. It'll be a 15-yard penalty if flagged in games, but Troy Vincent, the NFL's executive vice president, says the rule will also be enforced in ways similar to that of the use of the helmet rule, which typically leads to warning letters, fines in the weeks following, etc. This is the tackling technique that often results in lower body injuries. It requires officials to note two actions. If a defender, quote, grabs the runner with both hands or wraps the runner with both arms and also, quote, unweights himself by swiveling and dropping his hips and or lower body, landing on and trapping the runner's legs at or below the knees. The decision has led the football world into an uproar. Former defensive end J.J. Watt said, let's just move it all the way to flag football. That's where we're headed. Former secondary Emmanuel Acho, now an NFL analyst, says there's no such thing as a hip drop tackle, saying, quote, imagine you're trying to tackle Rob Gronkowski. How are you going to do it? Unless you are directly in front of him and he's in front of you, you've got to find a way to bring him down. Former player and head coach Tony Dungy says, quote, I'm all for player safety. We need to make the game as safe as possible. And I must admit, I don't know what a hip drop tackle is. Having played and coached defense, I can tell you there is only one way to make a tackle from behind without dropping your weight, which could be worse. We talked about this in the beginning, and defensive players went insane yesterday. Fans went insane yesterday. I sent a note, I think it was to Gary, I don't think it was to you. I'm like, wow, I'm really looking forward to that 72-56 game that we're going to start getting this year. I have nothing good to say about this, Steve. Nothing.
Oh, I'm in agreement. I did like the other two rule changes, but this one, and just start with the description of it. If a defender puts two hands on the player or wraps both arms around the player, how are you supposed to make a tackle really if you don't wrap up? We learned this in Pop Warner when we were kids. You wrap them up, you bring them down, and now you're asking me to make tackles without two hands, without two arms. How are you grabbing Derrick Henry if you're in the secondary player? You're a safety. How are you tackling Derrick Henry if you're not allowed to wrap him up? I mean, you'll never make that tackle. And I think it was J.J. Watt with the, you know, bring on the belts that had the flags, you know, attached to them. You're right. This is absolutely crazy. You're changing the way defensive players have learned to tackle their whole lives. I get the don't lead with the head, don't hit with the crown of the helmet, because we're taught from the beginning, you know, keep your head up, etc. But Now you're saying don't tackle with two arms or have two hands on them. I can tell you, as a little guy playing football, the way I tackled everyone, because they were all bigger than me, was I wrapped up, I grabbed a hold, didn't let go, and I rolled.
Yes.
Because that was the only way I could bring them down. I never rolled with purpose of, oh, I want to hurt them. Oh, I want to pin their leg underneath me. It's the only way I can make a tackle, because the guy's got 50 pounds on me. I can't make a tackle straight up one-on-one with him. He's too big.
I was a cornerback because I was fast and I was small. 5'10", 175, the same I am now. And that's the only way I could bring down guys who were headed off to college football at 6'4", 6'6", and who knows what else. Okay, the other two. I love the rule addition of, and this was actually proposed by your team, the Detroit Lions, teams will now receive a third challenge following one successful challenge. That one I like.
Correct. If you have a successful challenge, why should be penalized and it goes away? Keep it. And so I really like that. The one thing I would like to see them add to the challenge, I would give them unlimited challenges, but I would do like what hockey does. Look, if you don't win the challenge, it's a 15-yard penalty, automatic first down. Mm. If that's where you want to go, here you go. Put a little teeth into it. But I'm going to allow you to challenge as often as you want, because if you lose, you get penalized. In hockey, if you lose, the other team goes on a power play for 2 minutes. So it makes you decide, is it worth the challenge? Are you pretty much sure you're going to win? But I'm glad they reached this step, because to win a challenge on your first one or second one and then be done, it really allowed teams to not want to challenge anything early on, because they knew, oh, if I was wrong, I only have one left and I might need the two. If you're right, keep it. Now I like it.
You said you liked the other two, and I think I'm more confused than anything on this one, and maybe you can explain why I should like it. NFL owners approved a massive revamp of the kickoff play, which I have heard various views on, pro and con. Kickers will continue to kick from the 35-yard line, but the other 10 players on the kickoff team will line up at the receiving team's 40-yard line. At least 9 members of the return team will line up in a setup zone between the 35 and 30-yard lines. Up to 2 returners can line up in a landing zone between the goal line and the 20-yard line. No one other than the kicker and returners can move until the ball hits the ground or hits a player inside the landing zone. Blah, blah, blah. Touch marks will be marked at the 30-yard line. No fair catches allowed. In the event a team wants to attempt an onside kick, it'll have to inform officials of its intent and would then be allowed to use the NFL's traditional formation. No surprise onside kicks will be allowed. What is to like so much about all of that?
Well, one, the player safety portion of this is they're not allowing the players to get a full running start going all the way down the field, so they're at full speed when they come in contact with the opposing team's players. You cannot move, so the kicking team lines up at the 40. The receiving team lines up at the 35. There's a 5-yard neutral zone in between there. And having the kicking zone means the kickoffs are going to be between the 20 and the goal line, which means there's going to be a lot more kick returns, which is one of the things that I miss in the NFL, is seeing the kick returns by those teams. So if they catch the ball in that, they are required to return it. You cannot call a fair catch, but nobody's getting a big, long running start at a full head of speed. You're pretty much making contact, you know, like you're at the line of scrimmage on a regular running play. So it's really supposed to help the player safety. If you kick it into the end zone, then it's a touchback. I believe it goes out to the 30 as yes. opposed to the 25.
Right.
If it bounces in the safe zone and goes into the end zone, then I believe it comes out to the 35 or something like that. No, it can't be. It's got to be like the 25. But it's an interesting concept with the idea of, one, valuing player safety, but two, bringing the kickoff return back into the game. And I really think there's going to be a decent amount of touchdowns because of this, because you're not going to have the guys going at full steam from all the way across the field. It's pretty much what the play is in front of you, and there's not a whole lot of depth to that. So if you can figure out how to get a hole through that line of scrimmage, You just got to beat the kicker.
All right, we'll revisit this whether it's next week or next September as the season starts, because you sold me on more kickoff returns, because that's one of the most exciting plays in the game, and they've taken it away from us. Have a great week working on March Madness, Steve. We will hold down the fort without you, and I will see you on Monday morning.
Thank you.
Mitch. Shock and awe in college basketball. UMBC makes history in Charlotte. Gives it to Jenkins for the championship. Midcourt launches the shot. Oh, almost went in. Duke is the king of the dance. 2010. Got it. 10 seconds. Unbelievable.
The Mix Picks Sports Show.